Okay. So, this is going to be evidence-based herbal medicine. I am not talking about Chinese herbs during this lecture. I like talking about this a lot more than the toxicity and interaction stuff, as you can probably tell. I want to mention something. The lady over here who does surgery and was worried about St. John's wort, I misunderstood her question, and actually what I think she was referring to was the possibility that St. John's wort in combination with anesthesia can lead to serotonin syndrome, and that's true. So I don't know that we've documented it in dogs. I've never heard of it documented in dogs, but possibly because people don't use a lot of it in dogs. But I do think it's a possibility. And it points up, as she mentioned, that you really need to ask every patient that comes through the door, what drugs are they on, what supplements are they on, and then ask, and what other supplements are you on? Seriously, I'm not kidding about that, because they tend to not think of herbs as anything of consequence to discuss with you. So it is important, and my technician is trained to get the diet they're feeding every time, because you never know what they've read on the internet, and all of the supplements and herbs they're on every time. This doesn't sound a little bit buzzy to you, a little bit over? No? Okay, I'm going to just put this down here for a second. So we're now going to talk about mostly single herbs here. And I want to first give you a little bit of a primer on evidence-based medicine if it's new to you. Let me give you two definitions. The first one is by David Sackett, who was one of the pioneers of evidence-based medicine in human medicine. You know what? I need to go back. I need to tell you that I have got to sprint out of here after this session, and so there will not be time for questions at the end of the session. To make it up to you, here's my email address. I think it's probably also in the proceedings, but please write that down and feel free to email me if you've got questions. It's SWYNNDVM, and that's all one word, at bellsouth.net. So please do feel free to email me with questions, because I feel bad about having to go, but it was a choice of going to Europe or staying here for 5 minutes. What do you think? Okay. Definitions of evidence-based medicine. David Sackett, one of the really initial experts in this and one of the people who coined the term and helped move it along, called one of the older versions of evidence-based medicine, according to him, was the integration of best research evidence with clinical expertise and patient values. There is now a book on evidence-based veterinary medicine, and the definition in that book by Cocroft and Holmes is to develop the skills to find and appraise the literature pertinent to the cases we see and apply this evidence to the clinical decisions we make. I want to go through these definitions because I want you to understand this is a major area of misunderstanding, at least among my colleagues who use holistic medicine. What they believe is that evidence-based medicine means that you should only use well-proven therapies in practice. And if you are in practice long enough, I think you'll all realize that there's an awful lot that we do as art of medicine. I heard Andrew Weil once say that medicine and science has always had a very uneasy alliance, and it's the truth. If we were confined to using just well-proven therapies, we'd be in big trouble in the clinic. And these definitions of evidence-based medicine acknowledge that all we're trying to do is understand the level of evidence that supports our recommendations, as opposed to using just well-proven therapies to the detriment of, say, client compliance or client satisfaction. A primer, again, there are, depending on whose system you use, there are either three levels of evidence or four levels of evidence. I'm going to use the three level here. The first level of evidence includes at least one randomized double-blind controlled trial for the therapy in question. So needs to be very well designed, some sort of control, blinded in the most important ways. Another level one piece of evidence, if you've got a therapy supported by meta-analyses. For instance, I mentioned Kava-Kava before, a meta-analysis done by the Cochrane Collaboration, which is the evidence-based medicine sort of collaboration that analyzes the literature, showed that Kava was clearly effective in multiple trials. And what you do is you take clinical trials and pool them so that they are essentially one huge clinical trial. And then you look at the results with these larger numbers of patients and see if you get the same kinds of conclusions, get a valid conclusion. Level 2 evidence is not quite as strong. It's either a well-designed clinical trial that wasn't randomized, could be some kind of a case study using case controls, could be a laboratory study, but in the species of interest. So, for instance, if we're using a laboratory study with mice, and we are trying to say that this applies to dogs or cats, you can see why that really doesn't wash. As opposed to, for instance, I'll show you a trial in beagles using milk thistle. It was an experimental study, but I think it's a really important study because it's in dogs, and it tells us a bit about what's going to happen in dogs and where we can use it in dogs. Uncontrolled experiments that show dramatic results are also level 2 evidence, according to this system. Level 3 evidence, it's like me sitting up here telling you what I believe. Level 3 evidence, not very good evidence. Consensus opinions, white papers that aren't supported by evidence, for instance. Pathophysiologic justification, for instance, in vitro, gingolic acids inhibit 2C19, the metabolic enzyme 2C19. Therefore, what can you draw from that? What conclusion can you draw from that? You shouldn't draw any conclusion from it. Descriptive studies, studies in other species, these are all level 3 study types of evidence. So with that in mind, let's go through a few of these herbs to see what kind of evidence they have. Just a reminder, is a case report that involves a toxic event more important than level 3, and it probably is. Case report, that would probably be level 2 because it's a dramatic effect. So, yes, case reports are considered anecdotal and not all that important unless we're talking about a toxic event, and then you have to pay more attention to them. I mentioned that this guy, Matthias Schmidt, did this review on CAVA, talking about the evidence supporting these recommendations that it be banned. If you want to, this website I've just learned has been taken down. So if you want this reference, if you want to know more about it, I may even have the paper I can send you. If not, I can certainly send you the reference if you're interested in this. So in evidence-based medicine, herbs are a little bit different than a drug. We've talked about why they're different to study. They're complex. They're like foods. But the big thing here is that we have a historical database, and there is no place for this historical database, this historic context, like there is, for instance, there is nothing like that in drug therapy. This historical database is important because it does give us some guidelines on what the toxicities are. We know, for instance, from texts in the 1890s that lobelia, given in very high doses, is a respiratory depressant and can cause severe neurologic depression. Is that important today? Yeah, of course it is. We're not going to just dismiss it because it's historical. We don't have that with novel substances like drugs, new drugs, or even new nutraceuticals. I consider nutraceuticals and herbs in a completely different class because we do have this historical information on herbs. I want to just read you this quote from an herbalist called Jonathan Treasure, who is up in practice in Seattle, brilliant guy. He says, the current trend of presenting so-called scientific information about herbs divorced from the context of herbal medicine that defines their medical use is rather like presuming that knowledge of needles will provide an understanding of acupuncture. Anybody in here understand who has taken the acupuncture course knows what a big deal it is and how a needle doesn't tell you a thing. And the same is true of herbal medicine. Traditional medicine is a category of evidence in the European system, and the Canadian system has included that as a category of evidence as well. So we're behind them in that way. So herbal medicine is a little bit different, and I will give you an example at the end that will show you why we still need, in the absence of studies, to take that into account. So these are the reasons that they are not quite like drugs. We've got this empirical database. We've got the complex medicines that have polyvalent actions, and then we're talking about research that should address a whole herb and not an extract, because we can't make predictions about herbs from extracts. Just a reminder, look at all the different ingredients in St. John's wort. Can you make a guess about what's going to happen just by looking at the chemicals? No, we do need the evidence. We do need the studies. We talked about that already. So let's move to milk thistle. Has anybody here used milk thistle in practice? Good. So you always know and all know what it is. The seeds are used. That's what they look like. This is the plant. I've seen it mostly up in the Northwest. I haven't seen much of it in Georgia. I think you probably have it in this area. It is considered to be most active when you take the silymarin out. The silymarin is an active component. So as an herbalist, I don't like that, but I'll give it to you. It's okay to use the silymarin extract as opposed to the whole herb if you must. I want to tell you about these couple of studies that were done in the 70s and early 80s. The first one was by Florsheim, and what they did was they gave beagles an extract of the Amanita mushroom. That's the fly agaric mushroom. It's quite poisonous. The reason they did this was because they were concerned about the number of emergency room visits by children who had eaten this mushrooms in their yards, and it's quite toxic, and you can die from it. So what they did was look at a few different treatments to see what was going to work best. Something that had been in use at that time was penicillin. Another was cytochrome C, steroids, and they went ahead and tested silymarin too. What they did was they gave the Amanita mushroom extract orally, and then they divided the dogs into groups and gave them these different treatments. They gave them the treatments at time 5 hours after the mushroom intoxication, and then they measured the blood at 5 hours, 24 hours, 48 hours, 96 hours, and 192 hours after giving the fly agaric extract. And if you'll take a look at what happened over, over time, this is 24 hours after mushroom extract ingestion. And if you look at the controls, this is GPT and GOT, and then this lime green color is the GGT. The controls at this point, their GPT and GOT had gone over 4,000. But if you look down here at the prednisone, it didn't do nearly as badly, under 1,000 for both of those enzymes. Penicillin, under 500. That's pretty impressive. That was the most change in the GPT, and the other ones were almost unchanged. And silymarin, almost no change at all. The GGT was under 400. It was under 250. So this is 24 hours post-intoxication. If you go to 48 hours post-intoxication, the controls are back down, the controls that are still alive, that is. So they're back down. The GPT is still over 2,000. The other ones are more normal. The prednisone is going up, and this could be actually a prednisone effect, I suppose, but prednisone is still going up. PenG and silymarin, just almost negative. Pretty impressive. This study occurred in 1978. Did anybody learn about this in vet school? Yeah. There was a second study done in 84, and this group, what they did, they gave them silibinin. It's the same thing as silymarin. It may be a slightly different extract, but it contains the same flavonoids. What they did was give the dogs the same dose of the fly mushroom extract, fly agaric mushroom extract, and then they gave them the silibinin or silymarin. They did give it IV. And they had 12 dogs in each group. In the controls, a third of those dogs died. And on histopath, the liver was basically just a big mess. There was a lot of necrosis, generalized necrosis. Whereas in the silymarin-treated group, none died, and the liver histopath was normal. Pretty impressive. So we have two level two studies supporting the use of milk thistle. I want to take it one step further. I know this is an aha meeting. We don't really care about chickens, but I just want to show you this. They gave chickens aflatoxin. You know what a big problem aflatoxin is in feed. They gave these chickens aflatoxin intoxication, and then they gave them silymarin and found that silymarin, when they gave that on top of the aflatoxin, the group that got the silymarin had identical growth rates, ALT levels, to chickens that had gotten no aflatoxin at all. Completely protected them. So this would be probably level one evidence in support of silymarin. And I'd just like to point something out. Did anybody get those things that came around on the web after the diamond dog food fiasco with aflatoxin? And what was recommended to be given to these dogs? SAMe. SAMe, at the time I looked it up, did not have any support in clinical trials in dogs. Where was the evidence for that recommendation? So, I just want to point out that I think it's pretty well proven. I do use one of those products. I use Marin in my practice a lot, and I use milk thistle less than that. I like that extract. It's got a nice combination with the zinc and vitamin E in it. There are about a gazillion human products on the market, but I think Marin does a good job, or you can use plain milk thistle. All right, tea tree oil. Tea tree oil is, tea tree is a tree that actually does grow in Florida. It's from Australia. It's very highly aromatic. Has anybody here smelled tea tree oil? You know what it smells like? And you can imagine that with a high level of phenols like that, I mean, to me that reminds me of Pine Sol. It is antiseptic. You can expect that something that smells like that probably is going to have some antiseptic activity. This stuff was actually studied in the form of topical creams in two trials. These were uncontrolled trials by a group in Germany who's actually doing a whole lot of these for a particular company in Germany. And what they did was give the 10% cream, so it was an emulsion of 10% oil. In one trial, it was 53 dogs who had dermatitis. Notice the air quotes, dermatitis, because if you read this study, it's not really all that well defined. They talk about crusts and papules and oozing, and we don't really have a diagnosis. The other one, 57 patients, again, it was sort of a similar problem in that they just described these clinical signs in an uncontrolled trial, and they say that tea tree worked. It improved them. So I don't doubt that it does help, but you should know that this is not a very well, neither of these trials are very well controlled. The problem is that when you see the products available, for instance, over the counter in pet stores or health food stores, they're generally not at the 10% level. Generally, they're much less than that. They are only, it's kind of a whiff that you get, and that's it. So you want to be really careful if you decide to use tea tree oil that it's at the 10% level, that it's not in cats because it's pretty toxic in cats. And you just want to be careful in dogs as well. Just monitor them really carefully. Don't let them lick it. But potentially very effective. Just hasn't been studied that well quite yet. Boswellia. Anybody here using Boswellia? Yeah? What do you think of it? Do you think it works? Yeah, I feel the same way. I don't think it works all that well. I was pretty encouraged because there were like one or two human trials that suggested it worked, but most of them were in combination with turmeric or ginger or something along those lines. This is a study done, again, by the same group in Germany. It was 24 dogs in a multi-center study, but it was not controlled. And they had radiographically confirmed spine or hip osteoarthritis. They gave an extract at a level of 40 milligrams per kilo, which for an extract is pretty high. That might explain why they say 40 to 70% of the dogs improved. That's a pretty high dose. I don't know how safe that is long term. You would want to do blood work every 4 to 6 months if you have them on that. But they say that these dogs improved. Again, not a controlled trial. It's hard to tell. But it's a pretty high dose for an herb extract. Again, same group in Germany looking at echinacea in dogs with quote-unquote upper respiratory infection. They said that these dogs had kennel cough, bronchitis, pharyngitis, tonsillitis, non-thriving young animals. To my mind, they didn't differentiate it from chronic bronchitis as an allergic bronchitis. I had a really difficult time trying to interpret the results of this trial where they claimed that 92% of the dogs had good improvement. Again, it's an uncontrolled trial. They treated for 8 weeks. I don't know how to interpret it. This is not something that most herbalists would even use echinacea for. We do use it for respiratory infections. We tend to use it for lower respiratory infections, like pneumonia or bronchopneumonia. So I don't know how to interpret this either. You know, I don't know how to differentiate it from allergic signs, but they claim that it does help with upper respiratory infections in dogs, which are not the same as colds in people. Anybody heard of Chireto? Is that ringing any bells? Oh, goody, because this is one of my favorites to talk about. Chireto is a Chinese formula made more famous as a Japanese or Kampo formula. Same formula, two different names. In Chinese medicine, it's called Juling San, but in Kampo, it's called Chireto. Has five herbal ingredients. This Alisma orientale is a really important one. It is probably a diuretic, probably. Polyporus is a mushroom. Poria is a mushroom. Talc, you know what talc is. I guess it's it's not calcium carbonate. I don't know what talc is. I think it's calc. Does anybody know for sure? It's a mineral, but I can't remember what's in it. It's not calcium carbonate. Gelatin, you know what gelatin is. And what they did was test this combination in cats with cystitis, lower urinary tract disease. This work occurred at Ohio State. It was Tony Buffington's group. They actually did three studies. They gave, now this was probably an herb extract, and look at the high dose they gave, 500 milligrams per kilo of an extract, and found that it reduced struvite crystal formation. What they did was they made these cats have lower urinary tract disease by feeding them very, very high magnesium supplemented diets. It reduced struvite crystal formation and the supersaturation index. You guys have heard about this with the new foods out there. What they found clinically was that it improved the frequency of urination and the severity of the hematuria. And the three trials were put together slightly different ways. What they did in one of them was look at the different ingredients. They decided that alisma was one of the more important components of the formula. But these are at least level 2 studies. They are kind of controlled. They do some crossovers, at least level 2, maybe level 3, for this formula. Anything you can give cats that you think really works if they've got bad lower urinary tract disease, when we put them on the right diets, does that help all of them? Some of them are really resistant. We put them on, excuse me, penicillin or cosequin, does that help all of them? This, in my practice, has worked really well for the majority. I think this is really well worth trying. Where do you get it? I would get it. You can't get Chirato. You can't use the exact form that was used in these studies, unfortunately. The Japanese company is no longer making it. Since it's a classic Chinese formula, you can get it from Chinese pharmacies that would offer, that would produce it. And one of them, the one I order from, is Brian Herbs. I think that Vetri Science is about to offer this formula in the next few months, so you might be able to get it there. Okay, ginger. Has anybody personally used ginger for motion sickness or anything like that? Yeah, ginger is pretty effective. In human trials, very effective for things like post-surgical nausea, motion sickness, those sorts of things, basically nausea. In this study, it was an Indian group that looked at ginger after dogs were given cisplatin. Yeah, cisplatin. This was a dose of cisplatin that they found that was guaranteed to cause vomiting in all the dogs given. So they gave a guaranteed vomiting dose of cisplatin. They compared some different extracts. There were acetone extracts, water extracts, alcohol extracts, different extracts, and compared the efficacy to granacetron, which we don't use, but I guess is pretty close to ondansetron, something along those lines. And found that at 100 milligrams per kilo, the acetone extract was effective in reducing vomiting. These are some of these serotonergic receptors that they guessed would be involved. They didn't go further than that. That was basically chemical data. They didn't go further than that. I've not seen more studies on this. But again, I just want you to note, this is a pretty high dose. This is a higher dose than most of our books would tell us, most of the lay books, because there aren't very many professional level books. This is a higher dose than the proportional dose I told you about in the first session. And I just want to point out that a lot of times if we believe something does not work, it's because we haven't studied the right dose yet. There's a lot we don't know. Just found this study recently on senile cognitive disorders. Again, same group in Germany. Doing company studies, uncontrolled trial, multi-centered though. They did looked at 42 elderly dogs who had signs of disorientation, sleep or activity changes, behavioral changes, general sort of physical condition or vitality problems, activity problems. And they gave them a dose of ginkgo extract equivalent to 4 milligrams per kilo. And that is a pretty, that's the dose you'd kind of expect from the literature, 4 milligrams per kilo, and found that there was improvement. I'll be honest with you, I have not seen this paper yet. I've got it on order, so I can't tell you exactly how convincing their statistics were, but it is another uncontrolled trial. I did not find that ginkgo worked very well for me. So it may be, again, when you look at trials like this, it may be that that particular company's extract has something special about it, and this is something to keep in mind when you look at the data. Salt palmetto. Anybody know what this is used for in people? Prostate disorders, exactly. This was a trial done at University of Georgia. What they did was they took 20 hounds from the pound, and these were intact. They were asymptomatic dogs, no signs of prostate disease. what they did was monitor them for 3 months. They looked at the prostate by ultrasound. They did all the biochemical parameters, urinalysis, semen evaluation. They did measure testosterone, serum testosterone concentrations. And at the end of the study, killed those dogs and looked at the histopath and rechecked. And they did not find any differences in any parameter, including prostate size, between the control and the saw palmetto group. So I looked really carefully at the study. They used a very good product from Germany. They used what looked to me at the time, and this was years ago, this was in 2001 or 2000, I think, 2002. They looked at the time to what looked to me like a really reasonable dose. I question that these days. I think that maybe dogs do need higher doses. But one thing that's very different from this study and the human studies is that these dogs were asymptomatic. Because in human studies, what changes is the urine flow. So, if I had a breeder who really wanted to keep the dog intact, and this dog had clinically significant BPH, then I would probably go ahead and use saw palmetto, and I would play with the dose some. And again, long-term use, going to monitor the blood every 4 to 6 months or so. Warn the owner, they have to do that. Aloe vera. Aloe is something that's pretty commonly used topically for skin lesions. This was a study done at Auburn in beagles. They took 15 beagles and basically made a wound in the foot pad on both front feet. And what they did was compare no treatment to triple antibiotic ointment to aloe vera gel. What they found was that at 7 days of treatment, the aloe vera gel treated, and this is because the dogs could actually act as their own controls. You're putting each different treatment on a single dog and comparing all the dogs to each other. So what they found was that at day seven, the control wound and the triple antibiotic wound areas had actually increased while the aloe vera gel wounds had decreased. At 14 to 21 days, there was no difference between the two. So they all worked equally well in the end. But this is Steve Swaim, and what he wrote was that he thought aloe probably stimulated fibroblast proliferation and actually accelerated healing in the initial phases of wound healing. By the way, this is one of those plants I told you about that might be unstable if the gel is taken out of the plant and just put in a bottle. Most herbalists actually keep a plant in their office. So they just break off a leaf and send it home. Just a point of interest there. So this is pretty interesting. This was a study done at Minnesota on a combination of Chinese herbs and atopic dogs. Thank you. Is it really that time? Oh my gosh, that went fast. Okay. Chinese herbs and canine atopy. And what they did was take three herbs that were from a formula called Zemophyte. These three herbs were Romania glutinosa, licorice, and white peony. And what they found when they compared the treatment group to the placebo group was that the treatment group appeared to be improved, appeared to have less itching, appeared to have better looking skin. 37.5% in the treatment group improved as opposed to 13% in the placebo group. Unfortunately, that was not statistically significant. However, I talked to the researchers in this, and they were so impressed with it, they really thought a second trial was in order. Well, a second trial did happen, and this one was done by a different group. It was done in Britain, I think. Yes, it was done in Britain. And what they did was, it had a different name at this point, but it was the same three herbs. They treated a group of dogs, actually I don't remember, but I think it was well over 100 dogs, treated a group of atopic dogs at this dose, 200 milligrams per kilo, again, a higher dose than you would expect from the literature. And they also went up to 400 milligrams per kilo and found side effects at that level. At 200 milligrams per kilo, they got statistically significant reduction in a well-proven scoring index. So this is a clinical scoring index that's used for atopic dogs and found significant reduction in that score, which is a good thing. You want the score to be reduced. That product is available now in Europe called Phytopica. Does that remind you of a drug name that you know of? Phytopica. Going to be available from their website, they say, in 2008 from Shearing Plow here in the U.S., Phytopica. So it's three Chinese herbs, and that has been proven in a level one clinical trial. And by the way, I do use those three herbs. Sometimes I'll put them together in a formula, and I do think they're effective even when I use my version. So if you just look at this again, this would be level two or three evidence as when we're talking about dogs and cats. But if you look at what's been proven to work in people, if you look at the Cochrane collaboration, which is one of the more efficient ways to decide what is effective and what's not, herbal medicine sort of comes out better than any other alternative therapy when you look at the percentage of therapies that are deemed effective when they do their meta-analyses. Yes, the quality of the trials is poor like it is with much of alternative medicine, but herbs do come out pretty well. Zemophyte, I told you that atopic dermatitis formula, that one is clearly effective in people. Kava-kava, clearly effective for anxiety. Saw palmetto, clearly effective for BPH in men. And artichoke leaf for high cholesterol. Artichoke leaf, pretty, you know, the stuff that you eat. So eat more artichokes. I just want to now bring you back to this whole how an herbalist makes clinical decisions, okay? Say you have a cat that pees out of the box because it has interstitial cystitis or because it lives with three other cats. Why is it peeing out of the box? You can look at kava-kava if you're an herbalist for a number of reasons. First of all, in people, clearly effective for anxiety. We know this. Have to be aware of the rare hepatotoxicity, have to be aware of long-term use. But if you're an herbalist and you go back to or you are familiar with the traditional literature, you can go back to King's to confirm your suspicion. King's American Dispensatory from 1918 is available free on the web. And the description of kava is it's for neuralgia, anorexia, despondency, inflammation, and here you go, vesicle irritation, painful micturition, dysuria. This is one of the sort of heights of herbal medicine practice. If you can pick one herb that sort of fits the picture of the patient. And this is why we have to have the historical database, even though it doesn't find a place in evidence-based medicine. As herbalists, we've got to pay attention to it. And this is just a cat that we were going to go through, but I pretty much did that. So, talking about choosing herbal medicine products, we talked about that in the last lecture, but make sure that if there are scientific claims, the company can tell you what kind of claims they are. And if they don't know the difference between an in vitro trial and a randomized controlled clinical trial, I think I would stay away from that company. The good companies know the difference. They know what kind of evidence supports those herbs. Want to make sure that it's used by herbalists for that problem. You want to make sure that there are veterinarians or herbalists involved in the formulation and it wasn't some random biochemist who looked at the chemistry of the herb and decided something might happen. Ideally, the company would be a member of the National Animal Supplement Council and it should be appropriately labeled for herbs. It should be genus and species as well as the amounts in there and the extract type if it's an extract. Just to give you a few more resources, I mentioned the Essential Guide to Herbal Safety, which is probably the best on safety and interactions. If you like to know the clinical trials, especially from Germany, this Rational Phytotherapy is a really good book. It's getting old at this point. If you want to know the chemistry, this Trees and Evans Pharmacognosy is pretty good. Hard to get, but pretty good. I'll mention this one. This is the one I did with Barbara Fougere. I don't want to sell my book, but I have to tell you, it's the only professional-level textbook on herbal medicine for animals. This is why we did it, because there was nothing out there. So that'll probably be available if there's an Elsevier booth. If you are into online resources, this is one to know about. You're going to have to write this down, because I don't think there's an updated one. Health Notes. It's called Health Notes, all one word. Health Notes is basically a subscription service, and it is sold to different outfits. And so one year GNC had it, but it's not on their website anymore. So you just have to know to search for Health Notes and find whoever's offering it that year. Whole Foods offers parts of it this year. I get it by going to PCC Natural Marketplace. So just look up PCC Natural Market or Natural Marketplace and Health Notes. If you put that in Google, you'll get to the page. It's extremely useful because if you'll look at this, it actually has an evidence rating. So 3 stars means it's based on level 1 evidence in people. Realize this is a person online source. Level 2 evidence, level 1 evidence, tells you all the different things it's used for, tells you if there's only traditional evidence, tells you side effects and interactions. It's brief, but it's quick, and it's what you need in practice if you don't have the books. I like that a lot. Just realize it's for people. I told you about these antiquarian texts, King's American Dispensatory and the U.S. Dispensatory. That's from 1918. You know what? That's 1898, not 1918. King's is. Those are available free on the web. It's www.henriettesherbal, all one word, henriettesherbal.com. I think that should be actually in your notes. And I mentioned the Veterinary Botanical Medicine Association. If you're interested, join, because the listserv is active. There are a lot of experienced veterinary herbalists who can give you some insight on what they're using successfully and what they're not using successfully. It's really the only resource I know of to talk about herbs used in animals that way. I actually do have time for a question, even though we're getting close to the end. Anybody have a question? No? Yes. That was what? One of them was orally and one of them was IV, I believe. The oral what? The oral one was effective, yes. Anybody else while I'm powering down? Yes. Boy, you've asked a more complicated question than you know. If you're looking for what my teacher in herbal medicine called card tricks, a really fast response, you need to use high doses, and you're looking for something within a few days to a week, 2 weeks maybe at the most. Much of herbal medicine, though, is not really about the card tricks. A lot of what we're doing in herbal medicine is trying to become part of multimodal therapy. It's tonifying, it's organ support, and that sort of stuff doesn't happen fast. That kind of stuff happens over 2 to 4 to 8 weeks. So it really depends on what you're trying to accomplish, but many, many times you're not looking for the sort of 48-hour antibiotic response. You've got to be a little bit more patient than that. Well, when you put it, maybe, when you put it undiluted on a small dog, I have seen them just go down for 36 to 48 hours. They just don't get up. It seems to be reversible. Blood work was fine, but I don't want to see that ever again. Cats, I actually had somebody put it in a cat's ear for a chronic ear problem, which I didn't really recommend. And that cat was just very, very lethargic for a couple of days, and that was diluted. That was diluted to like 5%. I suspect, although I don't remember, I think that in the really big clinical trial they did see hepatotoxicity, but I suspect that if you did blood work on chronic use, you'd see that. But that's not, you know, really acutely, we just see them go down. Oh, gosh. Yeah, I do. Yeah, the Whole Dog Journal, I got to tell you, I am not excited about Whole Dog Journal anymore because they have got writers who don't necessarily know what they're talking about. And they recommended arnica, which herbalists know to be a fairly toxic herb. They recommended putting it topically on dogs for joint or muscle problems. I would not do it. The dogs will lick it. It's toxic. So don't take herbal advice from Whole Dog Journal. Thanks very much. I'm sorry I have to run. I appreciate it. Email me if you need to.